Good evening. In the news tonight, the vast and growing gap between rich and poor becomes more and more apparent. The Supreme Court decides to take up the case of President Obama's executive action on immigration. New York City's Vision Zero has been a success, but more needs to be done to protect pedestrians. There's a call to boycott the Oscars over its all-white nominees. And Bronx Public School students who like school less tend to be those who are disciplined at a higher rate. With these and other stories in New York, I'm Linda Perry, and this is some of the news for Tuesday, January 19th, 2016. Oxfam released a report which says that 1% now owns more than the rest of us combined, and the wealth of the poorest people, all 3.6 billion, has fallen by 41% since 2010. Meanwhile, the wealth of the richest has increased by more than $500 billion. In other words, 62 people, 53 of them men, own as much wealth as the poorest half of the entire world. Globally, it's estimated that super-rich individuals have stashed a total of $7.6 trillion in offshore accounts. If tax was paid on the income that this wealth generates, an extra $190 billion would be available to governments every year. The report from Oxfam comes as political and business leaders are gathering in Davos, Switzerland, for the annual World Economic Forum this week. The Supreme Court announced it will take up a review of President Barack Obama's executive action on immigration. It would allow up to 5 million living in the U.S. to come out of the shadows and work legally in the U.S. Justices said they will consider undoing lower court orders which blocked the plan from taking effect in the midst of a presidential campaign already roiled by the issue. The immigrants who would benefit from DAPA, the Deferred Action for Parents of Americans, are mainly the parents of U.S. citizens and lawful permanent residents. Daniel Altshuler is the Civic Engagement and Research Director with Make the Road New York.
This is a great day for immigrant New Yorkers and immigrant families around the country. It means the decision of the Supreme Court to take the case means that immigrant families are finally going to have their day in court regarding the president's immigration relief programs. And we are very confident that the Supreme Court will restore the rule of law by unfreezing immigration relief for parents, for undocumented parents, and ensuring that families can stay together.
As justices consider the case, Altshuler says immigrant families will remain vigilant.
People are going to be watching in the coming months and certainly at the moment when the Supreme Court makes its decisions to monitor what its impact is going to be on their families and whether families will be able to stay together. People are, you know, immigration, we've seen it come at the center stage in our national political debate, and immigrant communities are paying very close attention and are going to continue to fight to ensure both that immigration relief becomes a reality and then subsequently to ensure that a pathway to citizenship becomes a reality for all of the millions of undocumented families around the country.
The case will be argued in April and decided by late June. It's about a month before both parties gather for their nominating conventions. And you're listening to the news on WBAI in New York. This week is the 43rd anniversary of Roe v. Wade, the Supreme Court decision that legalized abortion. Rain Alexios reports.
This anniversary comes at a time of escalating restrictions on abortion rights. In recent years, hundreds of laws have been passed making abortion more difficult to access. Three people were recently killed at a Planned Parenthood clinic in Colorado Springs. And women have even been sent to prison for allegedly inducing their own abortions. StopPatriarchy.org and others are preparing to go down to D.C. for this anniversary to stand up for abortion on demand and without apology. They are counter-protesting the annual March for Life. Sansara Taylor, writer for Revolution newspaper and a key organizer of this trip, points out that the March for Life opposes not only abortion, but also birth control.
It's not right to even call it a march for life. They're not marching for life. They're marching for control over women. They oppose abortion. They oppose birth control. These people think women should submit to their husbands as their husbands submit to the Lord. It's like Bob Avakian pointed out, forcing women to have children against their will is a form of enslaving women to the dictates of a male supremacist patriarchal system, and that's what the cruel fanatics of the anti-abortion movement are really all about. This needs to be called out, this needs to be opposed, this needs to be exposed, this needs to be resisted. People need to join us in getting on the bus and going down to DC and telling the truth. Forced motherhood is female enslavement, and women need abortion on demand and without apology.
Stop Patriarchy's bus is headed down to DC this Friday, January 22nd, leaving at 5:30 a.m. Last year, they shut down the March for Life. Some of their members carrying out nonviolent direct action that prevented the anti-abortion protesters from marching in front of the Supreme Court for over an hour. Eight were arrested. This is Rain Alexios reporting for WBAI News New York.
For more information on the bus leaving from New York City going to D.C. on Friday to join the counter-demonstration protesting the so-called Walk for Life, you can go to stoppatriarchy.org. In international news, the abduction of three Americans from a Baghdad apartment over the weekend is the latest in a series of brazen high-profile kidnappings. It undermines confidence in the Iraqi government's ability to control state-sanctioned Shiite militias that have grown in strength as Iraqi security forces battle Daesh, the Islamic State group. Witnesses said men in uniform carried out the kidnapping in broad daylight on Saturday, 100 yards from a police station. There's a new report out which says that at least 18,800 civilians were killed in Iraq between January 2014 and October 2015. An increasing number of families with children and the elderly have encountered deadly ambushes as they try to escape areas controlled by jihadists. Daniel Dickinson reports.
The terrorist group ISIL, also known as Daesh, is currently occupying large swathes of Iraq. It's operating to a great extent in urban locations where most civilians live. Francesco Motta is the director of the Human Rights Office in UNAMI, the UN mission in Iraq.
ISIL continues to commit systematic human rights violations in areas under its control. It regularly targets civilians in terms of carrying out its military operations.
The report released on Tuesday details what it calls the severe and extensive impact on civilians. In addition to the dead, more than 36,000 people have been injured and another 3.2 million have been internally displaced. That figure includes more than 1 million children of school age. Francesco Motta says that in the town of Mosul, ISIL has also recruited up to 900 children as young as nine.
To train them, sometimes to use them as suicide operatives in their operations, but also forcing them to give blood and also to take armed combat roles in other parts where conflict is taking place.
The report details numerous examples of killings by ISIL in gruesome public spectacles, including by shooting, beheading, bulldozing, burning alive, and by throwing people off the top of buildings. There are also reports of the murder of child soldiers who fled fighting on the front lines in Anbar province. Ravina Shamdasani from the UN Human Rights Office in Geneva says the high death toll is only part of the picture.
Even this obscene casualty figure fails to accurately reflect exactly how terrible the suffering of civilians in Iraq is. The figure captures those who were killed or maimed by overt violence, but countless others have died from the lack of access to basic food, water, or medical care. The High Commissioner stresses that this report lays bare the enduring suffering of civilians in Iraq, and it starkly illustrates what Iraqi refugees are attempting to escape when they flee to Europe and other regions. This is the horror that they face in their homelands.
Those who can't escape and who survive can face enslavement. The report estimates that 3,500 people, mainly women and children from the Yazidi community, are being held as slaves in the areas controlled by ISIL. Daniel Dickinson, United Nations.
In local news, at a news conference in Queens today, city officials announced that 2015 was officially the safest year on New York City streets. This since record-keeping began in 1910. Mayor de Blasio says he's putting $115 million more into new capital funds, this to build on the progress of Vision Zero. The plan is for safe routes to schools and traffic calming measures on key thoroughfares. The city will also pilot new initiatives to test safer left-turn designs. The redesign of Queens Boulevard brought safer crossings and more crosswalks for pedestrians, protected bicycle lanes, expanded medians with trees and plantings, and reconfigured intersections that deter speeding and other dangerous behavior.
The $100 million investment in redesigning Queens Boulevard, I absolutely believe, is saving lives.
Queens Councilmember Jimmy Van Bramer.
Very few people thought we could ever achieve what we have achieved on Queens Boulevard. And I'm very proud to have gone to Community Board 2, and our district manager, Debbie Markell, is here with Commissioner Trottenberg. And we spoke in favor of this redesign. The Community Board voted overwhelmingly in favor of it, and we are seeing the changes taking place every single day.
Van Bramer says if we can see a successful redesign on a boulevard like Queens Boulevard, which used to be called the Boulevard of Death, we can make improvements everywhere in the city. Yadonis Rodriguez is chair of the City Council's Transportation Committee. He says the city can reduce pedestrian fatalities to zero by 2030.
I believe that when we change the culture on how drivers, cyclists, and pedestrians interact in our street, knowing that it's a major decision for someone who is behind the wheel to know that they should be driving the speed limit that we have in our city, 25 miles per hour, knowing that it is wrong and it is a crime to leave the scene after someone hit the street. I think it's enough fact, it's enough information for us to say, yes, we have to celebrate this 2 year of great accomplishment, that there's a lot more that we got to do.
And you're listening to the news on WBAI in New York. Civil rights leaders gathered on Monday at the South Carolina State House to pay homage to Dr. King. This was the first time that they gathered without the Confederate flag casting a long shadow over them. It was taken down over the summer after the massacre at the Emmanuel African Methodist Episcopal Church. A call for a boycott of the Academy Awards is growing, this over the Oscars' second straight year of all-white acting nominees. Spike Lee and Jada Pinkett Smith each said on Monday that they won't attend this year's ceremony. Lee, who in November was given an honorary Oscar at the Governor's Awards, said he was fed up. 40 white actors in 2 years and no flavor at all, he wrote. The Academy's president, Cheryl Boone Isaac, says they will conduct a review of membership recruitment to bring about diversity in the new members. Lee says where the real battle is in the executive office of the Hollywood studios and TV and cable networks. That's where the gatekeepers decide what gets made and what gets jettisoned. That's what's important, the gatekeepers, those with the green light vote. As civil rights legend John Lewis points out, Martin Luther King Day is not a day off, it's a day of service. And yesterday, many around the country got down to the business of making their cities and towns better places to live. In Washington, at a D.C. elementary school, President and Michelle Obama stuffed bags with books for needy children. Locally in the Bronx, parents and leaders came together to share results from a survey of students, teachers, and parents on discipline in public schools, and also to receive some training. The survey found that youth throughout the Bronx who like school less tend to be disciplined at a higher rate. These students tend to be less engaged in the school, less likely to participate in extracurricular activities, less likely to trust staff, less likely to turn to social workers. But they found that 79% of students turn to their peers and their parents for support. That's why the New Settlement Parent Action Committee, which works to improve public schools in the Bronx, recommends investment in youth and parent leadership. Spokesperson Emma Halls says that's because young people aren't asking for more social workers.
We want more social workers, but we think that the role should be expanded so they act more as youth developers in school instead of doing a lot of the mandated work they're doing now. And we also want transparency around budget priorities. And last but not least, a lot of students who dislike school, who are disengaged, are twice as likely to think that the purpose of school is to take tests and report feeling anxious at a much higher rate. We also did focus groups, right? So from the focus groups, we learned that a lot of students who had been pushed out, that there might have been sort of an incident that produced that, but there was a long pattern of really struggling with the Regents exams, struggling to pass them, feeling really disengaged and frustrated in school. And so because of that, we're recommending portfolio-based assessments, which is still an academically rigorous way of assessing how students are doing, but is more student-driven.
The report to reform school discipline at Bronx Public Schools is at shavedheadmedia.com, and we'll post it to our website.
Black and brown, we will fight!
And we'll kiss it, it's our right!
Black and brown, we will fight!
And we'll kiss it, it's our right!
Black and brown, we will fight!
In New York City last night, activists kept up the pressure. They marched in Brooklyn carrying Black and Brown Lives Matter signs, as well as signs which say housing is a right, justice for Tamir Rice, and end ICE/police terror, referring to the raids on Central American refugees by Immigration Customs Enforcement. Some of the demonstrators held up letters on posts. They spelled out, "We have a dream," with the hashtag ReclaimMLK. The news was produced this evening with help from Rain Alexios, Daniel Dickinson at the United Nations, citizen journalist Ash Jagrew, and Reggie Johnson at WBAI's Brooklyn studios. For WBAI News in New York, I'm Linda Perry. Thanks for listening. Over to you, Juliana.